Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for iOS Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
Last week, we gave you our hot take on the announcements at WWDC, but Jason Snell is here to do a deeper dive into what was announced last week. We also will show you an app that you should not be fooled by. It will not scan the Mediterranean to find refugees. And if you don't have Jason Snell by your side to recommend your next movie, there's an app for that.
This episode of iOS Today is brought to you by Automatic, the connected car company that improves your driving and integrates your car into your digital life. For more information, visit automatic.com/twit and enter the code TWIT to get 20% off your purchase, plus free shipping. And by Ratio. Take control of your watering with a Ratio Smart Sprinkler Controller. It's Wi-Fi enabled to allow instant access with a mobile app and has automatic watering schedules based on the latest weather forecasts to save water and to save money. Go to ratio.com/twit to learn more. And by Tracker. Tracker makes losing things a thing of the past. Pair Tracker to your smartphone, attach it to any item, and find its precise location with the tap of a button. Visit thetracker.com right now and enter promo code iOS Today for 30% off your entire order. Welcome to iOS Today.
Here we are.
Leo's on vacation. Jason is here. Jason Snell.
Hello.
Of Six Colors, formerly of Macworlds, the Incomparable podcast. I could spend the next hour listening to all the podcasts.
List all my things that I'm doing. Let's not get into that. But yes, I've deposed Leo temporarily.
So. Yes, you have. You're sitting in the big chairs. You said it. You feel like you're getting ready to take off.
I need to buckle up. That's right.
Put away your tray tables. Mm-hmm. Let's get started. Okay, so last week, obviously, was WWDC. You were there, hobnobbing, sitting in the front row, getting, I saw on Twitter you got in someone's picture, like they were taking a panorama.
Yeah, I wrote an article at the Apple Store because I wanted to see the new Apple Store, and so I walked around, and then I got there, and I thought, well, I've got an extra hour. I'm going to sit down at one of these tables. You're happy to sit there and write an article, and then somebody tweeted, oh, I think I got Jason writing an article in my panorama of the new Apple Store. And it's like, I looked at it. Yep, that's me.
That
I'm writing
you.
An article. That's it.
Yeah, I mean, it must be amazing. Like, you're there with all these people, your old friends, new friends, people you know from Twitter, and then you have to see the announcements and then write about them really fast.
Yeah, it's that would be a full week if all there was socializing. Because with Macworld Expo gone, it really is sort of the one event that everybody tries to come to in the Apple sphere. And so it's like everybody I know. I told my wife, it's everybody I know is in town for this week. But there's also a lot of news. There's a lot of stuff to write about, a lot of stuff to podcast about. And so it's a busy week. It's a very busy week. Good, but very busy.
Well, we're glad to have you here. So one of the things you wrote about was one of the surprising things that happened, surprising that it was so big, surprising to some people, was Messages. Messages got a big overhaul. A lot of people complained, that just looks like Snapchat. But you can do all kinds of things, and you wrote about that. So why do you think that people are so fascinated with messaging?
Well, Apple said Messages is the most popular app on iOS, which is pretty amazing, but Apple would know. And people do love messaging. If you think about it, and people who watch shows like this one perhaps are taking their devices a little more seriously. But in general, smartphones are for messaging. And I know my daughter uses Snapchat all the time. This is part of the culture is these messaging apps, all of which do way more than Apple's Messages app can do. This also is a trend, I think, from Apple to look at how people are using their devices and say, hey, everybody uses this thing. We ought to make it better. We saw it last year with Notes, which was always everybody just made fun of Notes. It's like, Notes app, it's boring. It's not that important. But it turns out, like, everybody who has an iPhone uses Notes. And if that's the case, maybe Apple should invest some time in making it better. And I think that's what they're doing with Messages this time. If you're going to have the number one app, if the messaging category is so huge, why would you not make your messaging app better to try and sort of keep up with the Snapchats and WeChats and Lines of the world. So they did.
Right. Well, it's interesting to me. I also have a daughter who loves Snapchat. Mm. And it's this combination. It's the real first combination, true combination of, I think, social media and messaging. Obviously, there's Facebook Messenger, which has been separate. You can DM on Twitter. But I feel like Snapchat really is the combined of the two. And that generation really does use it that way. We went to the MoMA, the SF MoMA, last week, and my daughter was on her phone. She was taking video, but she was also Snapchatting. So she was sort of, she wasn't saving it because, you know, that disappears. But she was experiencing it, talking to her friends, and also, like, posting it as a story at the same time. And that's fascinating to me.
Right. And I'm not sure Apple is really attempting to replace something like Snapchat so much as the fact that Messages, it's on every phone. It's sort of your default. Mm-hmm. You have to go get a third-party app if you want to do it. A lot of people aren't comfortable with that. Snapchat's not the easiest interface for people above the age of 20 to understand. But by adding these features to Messages, they're making the same stuff accessible to other people. So I think if there was a number one reason for Apple to do this, it's, hey, people seem to like this on these other platforms. If we bring this to Messages, more people will get to use stickers and, you know, animations and things like that, that have proven popular on other platforms and just haven't existed on Messages and iMessage before.
Right. It's interesting that you compared Notes to Messages, because to me, I mean, this is the way you think, which is fascinating to me. Notes is kind of boring, as you said, but all of their advancements were incredibly useful, like encrypted notes and, you know, being able to share notes more easily, that, like, really useful. But being able to, like, tap words in your messages and turn them into emoji is the opposite of useful.
That's a productivity feature. What are you talking about? Yeah, it's. I think it's how you look at it. Like, what's a productivity feature? What's a value feature in Notes? It's going to be stuff like that. What's a value feature in Messages? It's a totally different thing. Messages is about communication and having fun and connecting with your friends and your family, whereas Notes is about getting your, you know, getting things down, making lists, checking things off, stuff like that. So it's different. What they have in common is this thing, which is Apple knows, which we don't know from the outside looking in. Apple knows how much people use all those apps that are installed stock on the iPhone and the iPad. And they look at it and go, oh, geez, we got to do something here. So that was, I had the moment listening to Phil Schiller and Craig Federighi from Apple talking to John Gruber at his live talk show last week, and they made mention of this, and I suddenly made that connection. I put it down in my reminders, speaking of apps. I wrote down very quickly why Messages is like Notes, because I was like, I had that moment where I was like, oh, I see why they're doing it.
Right.
It's and you know, the selfie camera, improving that, or improving the camera on the iPad, I think those follow in that same category of things that Apple didn't really expect people to do. Mm-hmm. But once they looked, they saw everybody's taking pictures with their iPad. And you get the sense, like, if you're smart, you look at that and you're like, all right, I guess we should make the iPad camera better. And that's really, I think, what's happening with Messages.
Yeah. It's interesting, too. I mean, all the kids are on Snapchat. You know, young people are on it. And as you said, it's harder for older people to understand it in general. So those young people still need some other way to connect to those older people, which is interesting. I mean, your kids probably use Snapchat all the time, but not to communicate with you, right? I'm assuming they use Messages to communicate with you.
Yeah, I sent my daughter a Snapchat the other day, and she replied to it, and she said, you didn't even look at my reply. I'm like, yeah, I was busy with other things. It's like, you don't understand how Snapchat works. It's instant. But yeah, so I do often send them texts using Messages because I'm their dad, and therefore boring and don't get it. But right. Snapchat's interface is also really weird. I mean, it is not like any other iOS app. It takes some getting used to. I feel like I need to put in some more time. Because my initial response was, this is terrible. Why would you do it this way? But obviously it really works for so many people that
right.
I need to learn. I need some lessons from my daughter, tech lessons from my daughter. It had to happen.
Well, they've updated it recently, I think, for us. I mean, it is
for
a little
people.
Bit, yeah, it's a little bit easier to use. But I still think if you're saying, like, what time do you need to be picked up? Like, you know, those kinds of things are still going to be Messages. And
yeah, Snapchat, you're sharing videos of the moment and making stories and things like that. Yeah, if it really is like, which side of the street are you standing on? I think we can use Messages for that. That's good enough.
And so what about this rumor that appears to just be a rumor that Android was going to get Messages? Did you ever believe that?
I thought it was possible. I think it's a question of what's more important to Apple, making Messages and iMessage so vital and exciting that people are going to feel left out if they don't have an iPhone? Or is it making, you know, make it a platform that can compete on its own with all of the other messaging platforms that's out there? And, you know, the bottom line is Apple, it makes money selling hardware. So you have to make a circuitous path to get from iMessage for Android to value for Apple. And that's always the question to ask. It's like, wouldn't this be cool? It's, why would Apple do this? Why is this a good idea for Apple? And yes, it would be cool, but I think that's where it falls down, is I'm unclear on exactly why that would be the right move for Apple to make.
Right. I mean, it used to be harder to message with Android users. I felt like but that's sort of in the past. I mean, it used to be that people would say, I didn't get your message, or I didn't understand that emoji, or, you know, but that's not such a big problem anymore, I don't think, with Android users.
Right, and actually, the more complicated these messaging platforms get, and the richness that Apple's adding is a good example of that, the more difficult interoperability is, so you kind of have to let it be. They would have to create a version of iMessage for Android that had feature parity with the iOS version, presumably, or, you know, the danger is otherwise it's going to be like what it's going to be on the Mac, which is you can see them but not send any of these special things, which is not the greatest. So it adds a whole other layer of challenge. And, you know, you fall back to basic interoperability, or you use one of those third-party apps. And I think that's just that would be the number one reason for Apple to do it, would be to say, look, don't resort to someone else. We've got you covered. But I don't know if that's enough of a reason for them.
Right. So I know you've installed some of these developer betas, and you're not allowed to show them, but I think you're allowed to talk about them.
Yeah, well, I mean, we can talk about them. They were shown publicly last week, so I think that there's a lot that's fair game out there.
So have you been using the new features in Messages?
I have. I tried it briefly. I'm still trying to get a hang of it, and there's some stuff that is just not there yet. But it's exactly what they showed in the demo. It's a new interface. It's actually, speaking of something like Snapchat, if you look at the interface for the new version of Messages, they're like buttons in weird places, and you're like, is that the send button? And now it looks like a triangle or a play button or something. It's going to take some getting used to, because with this extra richness comes complexity that wasn't there before.
So what happens to people that you're sending these messages to? Have they been able to see, like, people who aren't on the beta?
If you're on iOS 10, you can see messages from iOS 10. Otherwise, they degrade back to maybe it's images in some cases, and some features just don't come through. And that's going to be the same on the Mac. Even with macOS Sierra, mm-hmm. It's going to be mostly just sort of you'll see what gets sent to you, but the sort of rich selection of things that's available on iOS 10, you know, won't go to other platforms and other versions. Mm-hmm. It'll be a simplified version.
All right. Well, moving on, you wrote another fantastic piece. You had several pieces this week.
Busy week, like I said.
On watchOS 3, that was my those were my favorite announcements. Use my Apple Watch every day. What was the most exciting thing for you that they announced with watchOS 3?
Well, the speed, that's really the number one thing, is they talked a lot about how it takes forever for apps to launch, right? I mean, there's so much in there. I'm so excited about watchOS 3 on so many levels, but it starts with the speed. It takes apps forever to launch. It takes not even forever to update, like complications. They don't update in a lot of circumstances mm-hmm. until you tap on them and launch the app and then go back, which destroys the whole point of having a watch complication. So in this new version, what they've done, another one of my favorite things, is they've repurposed that friends button on the side, and now it's a dock button, and you can put apps in it. And they've basically said that if you show your love of an app by putting it in the dock, or by putting one of its complications on a watch face, at that point, you're saying, these are important to us. I want these running essentially all the time. So they stay in memory. Even if they're not running, they are in memory, ready to go as soon as you want to activate them. And they are given requests for background updating, which means the data is fresh on them. So it should really change not only the app launching experience, but the complication experience, because all the complications are going to be updated in the background in a way that they can't be now. And it also means that home screen, full of all those little circles that are very hard to tap on, is now more of a last resort rather than being the way you interact with apps.
That's going to be great. It's interesting. I mean, you say they kind of were admitting that they got it wrong. With the friend, I never used the friends tab because I guess they just assumed we were going to be sending messages and calling people a lot more on our watch, or the thing that was, you know, sending our heartbeat or sending sketches. I never did that.
I get why it was a big idea and why they might have been sort of seduced by it. Like, oh, this is going to be so cool and kids are going to love it. Maybe missing the fact that you need kids to spend money on an Apple Watch and have all their friends spend money on an Apple Watch. And mm-hmm. is that going to happen with a first generation product at the price that the Apple Watch was? I think that was a mistake. But I guess I can see why they made it. That said, on the day they announced it, I thought, oh, that's a terrible idea. And I think everybody thought that's maybe a bad way to use the button. The one button on your watch is for this fringe feature. So they admitted it, basically, and said, look, these are mistakes we made. This was their first real chance to make substantive changes to the watch interface. And they did. And that's, I think, something we have to applaud. I think it's really exciting that they're willing to make those changes. And another fascinating tidbit that came up at the talk show, Craig Federighi pointed out that the Apple Watch, they really solved for battery life. They were deathly afraid that they were going to have stories of the Apple Watch not having enough battery life and running out in the middle of the afternoon or evening. And so that's what they planned, is everything was devoted towards saving battery life. The problem is, it worked, right? I mean, I very rarely come close to running out of battery life, and most people will say that. It's not all, but most people will say that. You've got the smaller watch like you do, mm-hmm. you've got a little less battery, and if you use the fitness features, it uses that battery more, and that's when you can run into trouble. But what Federighi said on stage was, look, it turns out we've got extra battery that we weren't using, and we've got extra RAM that we weren't using, and watchOS 3 uses those. So it's almost like you're going to get a hardware update inside your watch when you go to watchOS 3, because watchOS 2 is basically treating your watch like it doesn't have as much memory as it does or as much battery as it does. And that's how they're able to do these new features and make the watch faster, more responsive, is because they understand how people use the watch. They understand that they have more battery life now. And so they can afford to have stuff running in the background. It's great news for people who bought an Apple Watch, because the fear was this hardware is so limited that there's only so much they're going to be able to do. And actually, it turns out they can do a lot, because they were not close to the limits of the battery or memory on the device.
So did that surprise you? Because I was fully expecting that we were going to have to buy another watch to get all the new features.
Yeah, I'm sure there are a lot of new features we don't know about that will be part of a new watch model this fall, probably, and that we'll have to roll our eyes and be like, oh, I really want those features. I'm going to have to buy a new watch. But I am a little surprised. I knew about the battery life. I think we all thought, I heard so many people who say, yeah, I go to bed and I'm at 60% battery, that maybe Apple could loosen the screws a little bit on, mm-hmm. on the watchOS battery usage in order to get some benefits. I didn't know about the memory. I think that's a fascinating little tidbit that he dropped. That no, even memory, they were really conservative, because they were afraid this thing was going to be a flop because it didn't last the day or it was going to crash. And now they're able to sort of back off on that and be like, oh, it wasn't so bad. So we'll see now. There may be a rash of people complaining that the watches can't last through the day now, because they're definitely pushing it more than they were. Yeah. But if the trade-off there is that apps that were essentially useless because you had to wait forever for them to launch, if the trade-off is, yeah, okay, the battery life's not as good, but you can still get through a day and you can use apps, finally, that's a good trade-off, I think.
I think so, too. And they're getting rid of that spinning flower of death. They actually got rid of it, and now it's a timer, right? If you actually have to wait, I watched a demo online. If you are waiting for an app to load, it's the timer icon, no longer that.
I guess that spinner just was poison for everybody,
I think so.
Because we all saw it. Everybody who's using watchOS 2 has seen that spinner, and it's just, you know,
yes.
it you basically rage quit at that point.
Right.
Rage quit on the Apple Watch is very gentle. You just put your wrist down and forget about it.
Right,
it's still on. There's still some rage.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, like you said, I mean, I'm one of those people that never gets to the end of the day. I do yoga that's 90 minutes, and I keep it on there, and that's for 90 minutes. It's looking for my heart rate. I get it. It's a lot, and that's a weird use case. I have the smaller watch. And maybe there's just something wrong with it.
I wonder if one of the tweaks in watchOS 3 might be to try and save a little more battery life when you're in fitness monitoring mode.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, you would assume that since this is the example of when you might run down the battery, if they've also added some features to reduce battery usage in those scenarios in order to, you know, not have your watch run out at 7 p.m.
Right, just for me. I want them to do watchOS just for Megan.
Well, you're not alone. I mean, I talked to a developer who who's a woman and has the small watch and goes running every day for like a long distance. And she says, I push the battery to the edge on my Apple Watch too. So mm-hmm. those scenarios, there's got to be something else going on or the battery's going to run out. So right. I would not be surprised if they back off a little bit on the power usage of the fitness features in order to make sure they've got enough battery life.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I have a charger here at the office and then I just charge. I think, what do you think about just getting past, because I think when they first announced it, I mean, we expect our iPads to last longer than the day because mm-hmm. of how we use them. We expect our iPhones now in the beginning to last longer than the day. So I think there was, in the beginning, there was an outcry of like, our watches will only last a day. And you don't really hear that anymore. You know, it's like, as long as it gets through the day, that's fine. So I think there's a change there, too, in thinking like, we're going to have to charge it every night. That's just the way it is.
Yeah, I think the advantage is having used a Pebble for a couple of years. The Pebble would go 6-7 days. I actually didn't have a charging habit for the Pebble, so it always ran out of battery life on me because I wasn't charging it every night because I didn't have to, and then I just never charged it until it died. The advantage of the Apple Watch is I just put it on the charging cradle every night when I go to bed, and it's charged in the morning. So the only thing I think you're really losing is sleep tracking. If you want to do sleep tracking on the Apple Watch right now, there are apps that'll do it, but you basically, like, when you are getting ready to go to bed, you're brushing your teeth and all of that, charge it then, mm-hmm. and then put it back on, and then when you get up in the morning and you're going to get in the shower or something, charge it some more then.
Right.
You can do it, but ideally it would have enough battery life that you could get through and use it as a sleep tracker, because I think that's the number one place where they could use it. Well, that's number two. Number one is keeping the face on all the time. Mm-hmm. I think that's going to be their number one priority for a new watch, is using some of that battery power to keep the face on maybe all the time, because that's annoying that sometimes, you know, you turn to look at your Apple Watch and the face is blank and you got to waggle your wrist in order to see it.
Yeah. Or just, I mean, it takes longer than you want it to.
Right,
you know,
right.
It should just appear.
I wonder with watchOS 3 if that's something that they're doing too, is being a little more, using some of that battery to just be a little more aggressive about turning on the display. Mm-hmm. Not leaving it on all the time, but just, you know, when it senses things, being a little more generous about it, because maybe they were a little too aggressive that you probably didn't want to move there. I'm not going to turn on. And that leads to a lot of frustration when you're moving.
Well, I liked the SOS feature. To me, that was really interesting, not just as a feature, but just as an outlook of, I mean, it seems like they really know that everyone really only needs one really, really good reason to have this watch. And for caregivers, whether you have children or whether you're caring for an older adult, that is one really good reason to have like a button that they could just push and it would notify emergency services mm-hmm. or your contacts. I thought that was really an interesting turn for them.
It's that old I've fallen and I can't mm-hmm. get up thing, right? Yes. Which is, how do you do that? And it's like, well, you've got this network connected thing on your wrist and you just hold down the button and not only will an emergency call be placed, but your emergency contacts will be notified about your location, not just for people who need care, but also I've heard from several women who've said, you know, I'm walking around streets at night and I'm concerned about mm-hmm. being in an uncomfortable position, and being able to call for help is an important thing for me. And I think that's great, too. I think you've got it exactly right, which is Apple wants to have that reason that gets you over the hump to buying an Apple Watch. And whether it's fitness tracking or it's the SOS feature or, you know, who knows what else, it just takes one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, I mean, I think
the wheelchair feature is another great example,
yes.
right? Which is, again, what's the big slice of the market for that? It's not enormous, but it allows Apple to reach a different audience and also talk about accessibility and about the importance of this product beyond just people who can walk. Mm-hmm. They added a whole bunch of features for people in wheelchairs, and mm-hmm. that says something about sort of Apple's the way Apple views itself, but also it's just kind of a cool feature that is going to maybe be enough for everybody in a wheelchair to be like, they care about me, and that says something.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think you're exactly right, walking home alone. Not just parents thinking of their young children, but maybe parents thinking of their college-age children walking home alone. Like, I mean, Apple already knows that's an issue. I'm sure they know how many parents track their children on Find My mm-hmm. Friends, which I'm personally not comfortable with, but having something like this, where there was an emergency, I know that they could, you know, hopefully press the button if there was an emergency.
Right.
I really like that, yeah. Okay, so now another piece that you wrote was about how Apple is opening up to non-Apple.
Right.
So no Android messages, but there's a lot of, they're not opening all the way. You called it, I think, a bridge out of the gate. But, I mean, maybe it's like, are they not like really opening the gate? They're
well,
just
you know,
bridging?
Apple is not, you know, they're not Google. They're not doing Android. Apple's playing by its own game. It wants to control what it feels like it needs to control. But the old Apple was very much like, you know, you guys are all lucky to be here. We're great. To developers especially, whether it's hardware or software developers, we're great. You're lucky to draft off of our greatness and make a business out of it. I really believe that, like Steve Jobs, I really believe he felt that way, that the Apple ecosystem was a bunch of people who were making their businesses on his genius. I think it was an issue with Steve. What we've seen in the last few years, though, is Apple embracing what I said was not Apple, like other people. And whether it's messages having an app store, or whether it's the Siri API, or, I mean, you can go through the list. Like, there's so many different places now where third parties have access to things that they didn't have. Like, 3 or 4 years ago, there was almost nothing beyond, like, you could run your app, and good luck. Like, your app was in a box. Maybe your app could copy some data to somewhere else, but that data couldn't come back because the apps couldn't talk to each other. And it's a really different world now where there are so many different ways where third parties can tie into what Apple's doing. Maps is a great example where, you know, Maps is super important for Apple. They created their own Maps database in order to square off against Google instead of relying on Google's Maps database. And now they've got plugins in Maps where different apps can tie in directly and put their data inside of the Maps app. So there are a lot of initiatives that Apple seems to be going through on iOS that are opening up portions of the system to third parties. And the third-party developers are thrilled about that. But it's also just strategically, it's a big shift from Apple. Obviously, that used to be a sacred cow, and it seems to be gone. So it'll be interesting to see where they go from here. How much more do they open up to third parties? I don't know, but it's certainly a trend now. It's very clear.
Yeah. I mean, there was, I guess, only six categories or five categories that they're opening up for Siri, which yeah. is limited to me just in the idea of the future that we want, which is like having an Apple TV that works like our Amazon Echo. That's what I want.
Yeah, I think it reminds me a lot of when they brought multitasking to iOS in the early days, where it was multitasking, but it was like for three things. Like you could do audio or navigation. I forget. There was very limited number of things you could do multitasking for. And that was because they were being careful and it was new and they weren't sure how it was going to work. I think the Siri API is very much like that, where they decided five or six things that they were going to build for this version, see how it goes, see what the issues are, and then build out some more. Keeping in mind that every time they do this, they have to like build a whole like linguistic map on every language they support for all the phrasing for that particular domain, whether it's ride sharing or whatever. So it's a lot of work to set that up. The good thing is that then if you're a developer, all you have to do is plug into it and say, here's how I respond to these queries, and you're done at that point. Developers don't have to build language understanding technology into their apps. It's built into Siri. But I think that limits Apple. So I would be shocked if there weren't another half dozen, if not more, Siri types next year.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's Renee Ritchie's big complaint whenever we talk about the Amazon Echo. He's always like, well, it's great for you in the United States. And so some of the things they showed off at WWDC were messages. It was like, well, you can do this in all languages right off the bat, which is, that's why it's so much harder. You know?
Apple's playing a different game than Amazon for sure. And if you look at across features and where the various stores are, storefronts, you know, Apple, and I think Apple does a better job than Google, and both of them do a way better job than Amazon, which Amazon seems to be very focused on just rolling things out in the U.S. It's not even in English. It's in the U.S. So Renee in Canada, he can't even get Canadian English access to Alexa because it's just not there. So it's a tougher game that Apple has to play doing multiple languages because you've got to have the data sources in those countries, and then you've got to have the language processing stuff. It's a lot of a lot goes into Siri beyond what we think, I think.
And do you think there will be like an Amazon Echo type Apple TV Siri?
I hope so. I mean, it makes a lot of sense to me. They have Beats makes a speaker. They've got Apple Music. Having a device that has Siri embedded in it that can play music and that's tied directly to Apple Music seems like that's a product they should probably make. And I feel like the Echo has shown that there's room for that product, and of course Google's doing their version of it too. So yeah, it makes a lot of sense to me. I hope it happens. I don't know. Apple's funny that way. They may or may not embrace that, but it makes a lot of sense. I think the presence of Apple Music makes it way more likely, because that would be a great Apple Music kind of product.
And so what about tvOS? Was there anything in that they announced? Do you use Sling? That was the big announcement. You can watch regular TV.
Yeah, they have some live TV stuff, which I think was kind of cool. And the idea that apps can say what live channels they support so that you can tune to a live channel using the Siri remote, which is a pretty cool idea. And you'll be able to do that on iOS, too, on iOS 10, which is a nice thing. As a cable subscriber, I really liked single sign-on. The idea that you can sign in once and say, here's my cable company, here's my username and password, and then apps will be able to verify your subscription without asking you to go to a website or put in your password or anything like that. Because that's a real pain when every single video app you download on the Apple TV requires you to do that dance again. Mm-hmm. And I would love for them to see to do the flip side of that, which is you could say you're a cable cutter and it won't even show you the apps that require cable logins. Just like, forget it. But this is good for those of us who have cable and want to use these video services. It's a big interface improvement to only have to enter in that data once.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's always funny to me when I hear people in my normal life that don't really think, I know they don't really spend too much time thinking about security, and when they complain about when you have to change your Apple ID, your password, how many times you have to enter it and what a pain that is. And I have to restrain myself from saying, but you want to be secure, right? And like, you're using a lot of Apple products. What else are they going to do? But I usually don't say that. I say, that sounds hard. I'm sorry you have to do that.
Yeah, well, you know, security stinks, but it's better than not having security.
Exactly. I agree. So let's see. I think we covered everything that you... just your general thoughts on the betas so far.
Yeah, it's funny. Obviously, the watch stuff, which I haven't used, is the one I'm most excited by, although... To install it, you have to have the iOS 10 beta on the phone that is attached to the watch. And installing the first beta of iOS on the phone that I use every day, that sounds like a bad idea. So as much as I want to use watchOS 3, I am going to avoid that for now. I really like the design of iOS 10. I really like the new widgets in Notification Center. The idea that there are these little bubbles that are expandable. That's another place where Apple has opened it up. Like, your apps are running code and doing animations and things inside their notification bubbles. That's something that wasn't really possible before for third-party apps. So that's really exciting. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, I don't know. I'm looking forward to using the Siri on the Mac and see how that is, because that's an interesting thing. So we'll see how that goes with Sierra. iOS 10 is funny. We've spent a lot of time saying, oh, I wish Apple would do some software updates that were more about a bunch of little things and making everything a little bit better rather than some big idea. Well, that's what we got. And now I hear people complaining about it because people do that. But I think that's maybe okay. Talking to developers last week, they were really happy that this iOS release isn't going to ruin their summer or anything like that. It's like a bunch of little things that they can adopt as they need to, rather than some big release that's going to require them to rewrite all of their apps for the fall. And I think as a user, the visual changes will be really striking, but functionality-wise, it's not like a radical departure from what's come before. It just is going to look a little different.
Mm-hmm. So, of course, you can get the public beta, I think, in a couple months, in July. And I guess it's July now.
I think it's July, yeah. July. So next month there will be a public beta of iOS 10, and people get to play with that stuff. And if you're willing to live on the cutting edge a little bit, those public betas are usually a lot more safe than the developer betas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have someone here that has installed them on his regular phone that he uses and his watch. That's the way he rolls. So I get to look at it and...
Don't call him because he can't answer. He's running a beta. It's probably going to crash.
Yeah. Right. We're going to talk about some news. We're going to talk about... we're going to answer some questions. But first, we are going to talk about Automattic. This is the Automattic. It is our sponsor, and it is a little device that goes into the ODB port in your car. You've heard Leo talking about it. I have one, too. I love it. It shows me just what kind of driver I am. Do you have one as well?
I do. It makes the little chirps. It's adorable.
Yeah. It tells you when you're speeding. It tells you the hard brakes. Mm-hmm. I guess it tells you maybe when you're going over 80.
Yes, it does all those things. Hard brakes, hard accelerations. When you're going over 80, it gives you a little chirp in the, just right out of the unit that's plugged into that port underneath your steering wheel. Basically, it's back.
Back
in there.
It's super easy to use, and if you have, if you like to keep track of all the things, this is a great way to do it. Your car probably hasn't fully kept up with technology unless you have a brand new car. Automatic can help you keep up, so you don't have to buy a brand new car with all the bells and whistles. This just plugs right in. It can, if your check engine light on, it'll tell you what that means before you have to go to the shop. The performance data will help you keep track of your teenager's driving stats, which is useful if you have a teenager. If your teenager needs help fighting the urge to text while driving, Automatic can set your Android phone to do not disturb mode and disable your keyboard at the same time. The Automatic Dashboard web app provides granular information, so you can export trips. You can easily file business expenses using popular apps like Concur and Expensify. The Automatic app platform integrates with the Amazon Echo, with your Nest, with your mechanic, FreshBooks, IFTTT, and more. You can even locate your parked car with the Automatic app on your Apple Watch or on your Pebble. There are no monthly fees or subscriptions required. The Automatic will never sell your data. Automatic is normally $99.95, but if you use our special offer code TWIT, you can save 20%. Just go to automatic.com/TWIT and use the offer code TWIT to save 20% off the regular purchase price, and you get free shipping. I highly recommend it. You can check your score of how good a driver you are. Very helpful, competitive, if you are into that sort of thing. And we thank Automatic for their support of iOS Today. All right, so let's see what is in the news this week. This was big news, I have to admit. I guess I don't really watch Netflix on my iPad enough to, or I don't multitask while watching Netflix on my iPad to know that this is a big deal, but I guess it is a pretty big deal. Now you can finally get picture-in-picture for Netflix.
Yeah, I know it's big. I know a lot of people who watch Netflix, have Netflix going while they're working, and it's, you know, I don't know how they do that either. But they do, and now you can put on a movie or a TV show in the corner while you're doing other stuff using picture-in-picture, which is, I love picture-in-picture. It's a great feature. So seeing it, Netflix is a natural addition, because I you know, like I said, I know a lot of people who love watching movies on their computer while they are working, and now they can do it on their iPads.
Yeah, I don't support that.
Yeah, I don't think they're watching. I think they're listening more than anything else, and then they'll occasionally glance over.
Right.
And provides them with some companionship, and you know, that's great. I'll do it with baseball games, but I'm not sure I would do it with
a movie. Netflix like that. I mean, I support it with us. I hope you're getting all your laundry folded, your dishes washed, your work done, and you have us in your little picture in picture. But Netflix, it just seems like, I don't know, you're watching like a movie or a dramatic, I don't know,
but if I've got maybe an old Star Trek episode or something on, and then I get a notification I can see popping out and answering the email while Captain Kirk is still up in the corner or something like that, I could see that.
I don't want to judge.
No, but people do it, and it's, picture-in-picture is a great feature, and it's been surprising how slow it's been for some apps to support it.
Yeah.
So I'm glad Netflix is on the train now.
Well, in the podcast app, on the iPad, didn't it take a while too to get picture-in-picture on the podcast, the video podcast?
That could be. The video support in the podcast app has been shaky for a while now.
So at WWDC there were also the Design Awards, which is a great place if you're looking for well-designed apps. Tell us a little bit about the Design Awards in general.
Yeah, these are the Apple Design Awards. They are from Apple. This is actually one of these cases where this is not some group of people who have a bunch of tech journalists vote on things. This is like the Star Chamber, the secret cabal inside of Apple. They determine what apps they think best represent the platform and use platform technologies. You get this fancy Apple statue with a, I think it has a battery inside it, and it like blinks and glows and stuff. It's pretty awesome. So this is Apple's one chance a year to really award and recognize the apps that they think best represent design of new apps on iOS. And so, you know, every year they give them out, and every year some developer's year is made by these apps.
Yeah. Well, is that where everyone heard about Monument Valley, or was that pretty big before?
I think people heard about it, but that definitely was one of the things that was honored, for sure, because it was so beautiful.
Right.
And Ulysses was a winner this time, which is a text editor, and that's a great example of, like, really carefully chosen interface design, because, you know, there are lots of text editors out there, but Ulysses, you know, it's winning a design award. It's not just that it's editing text better than anything else. It's because of the very careful approach that they took to their design on iPhone and iPad.
Yeah, Leo talked about that. And then last year, wasn't Aalto's Adventure, did they win an award? That was something I learned from you early.
I think so. I think that may be. Yeah. I think they do definitely like to talk about games too, and not just things like productivity apps. They want to spread it out in all the different app categories, and they do a student ward. It's a great place to find apps that, I mean, this is Apple saying these are the kind of apps we want people to build on iOS.
Right. I tried to download a bunch of them, and of course so many of them did not work on my iPad Pro. Why is that?
Yeah, well, it takes extra
work, but then they, you know, I have to do this.
Oh yeah, because that's an iPhone only app.
Okay.
Basically, so.
Yeah. So they'll work, but then not in.
Yeah, I wish that they would rotate, like.
I wish they would too.
And just be in the center of the screen on the iPad
Why
when they're
don't
in
they
emulation
do that?
Mode, but Apple doesn't. I don't know. It must be, like, complicated with the accelerometer and stuff, because they don't rotate on iPhone, but.
I don't like that, but I did find one. The list of things I don't like. Chameleon Run, which does work. And this was pretty cool. So this is a game. See, like, you have to use your thumbs. And you have to jump over. So you jump with your right thumb. And then you have to change color. Oh, or you crash.
Yeah.
Now, you were saying before the show this reminds you of a game.
Yeah, it reminds me of Runbo a little bit on Wii U that is color-based. Like, the colors are part of the challenge is, like, you got to land on the right colors or skip the wrong colors. You're not having any luck there.
It's like, this is actually pretty good for me.
And Noodle Cake is one of the developers of this. They do Super Stickman Golf, which is one of my favorite all-time iOS games. So it's cool to see.
Super Stickman Golf. I'll have to check that out.
Oh, man. Super Stickman Golf. And Super Stickman Golf 2. Those are the best. They're not for people who like golf. They're for people who like. No, I'm not a golf person, but it's just they're ridiculous arcade style games where you have to hit a ball around and you get power ups and actually great network play in Super Stickman Golf. That imagine playing cartoon golf where everybody is being judged not by how many strokes they take, but just who gets to the hole first, and it leads to it's ridiculous and great. So they're a great studio. So it's nice to see that they're involved in. The ADA winner.
I'll have to let my parents also know about Super Stickman Golf.
Oh,
they're in Arizona right now not playing golf because it's 100 and a billion degrees.
Yeah, it's about 120 right out there right now. My mom's there too. But if you don't like golf, because it's really not golf, it's some ridiculous cartoon parody of golf, but it's a great game.
And you don't have to go outside. Good to know.
Yeah, I think there's a new version coming hopefully soon. So.
So there was other big news on Friday. Apple has some more challenges in China. I thought we would talk a little bit about that. Everybody wants to be in China, obviously. Biggest growing middle class. Apple products are super popular in China, but it's getting a little bit harder for them. So this story in the Wall Street Journal talks about a company, about how now Apple can sell iPhone 6 in China, but for a while they couldn't because of a patent dispute. The company was Shenzhen Bali, and they apparently had some phones. I think if you scroll down, you might be able to see the pictures of their phones, but they look sort of like, I guess we don't, there's not on the, I think I saw them somewhere else. They look a little bit like iPhones, but I feel like there's something else going on here.
Yeah. Also, is China famous for its protection of intellectual property? It's really weird. So many of us talk about China and the huge market there, but it's obviously incredibly complex. There are a lot of cultural differences that go on there. When Apple invested in that Chinese ride-sharing service not too long ago, people were saying, I'm not quite sure why Apple did that. And You know, one of the reasons is because Apple, it probably wants to be seen as being very supportive of Chinese companies, and that perhaps that's also a way that Apple stays in the good graces of the Chinese authorities, mm-hmm. is by making gestures like that. And it's not, you know, culturally it's just different, and that this is a huge economy, but it's run by a central government, and there are probably lots of ways that you need to kind of pay in to have access to that market. And so something like this, it's interesting. Is this a shot across the bow, or is this somebody who's going kind of against what the main people who are dealing with Apple want to do? You know, it'll be interesting to see how it resolves. But this is always a challenge with any outside company in China is, you know, you gotta do it right. Now, Apple says the right things about it, but these are always the risks. Is, are you going to be allowed to run your business there? You know, and to what extent? There was just a big story about the opening of the Shanghai Disneyland and how Disney had to completely change its approach to theme park business because if they wanted access to the Chinese market, they had to change their ways from how they operate in the rest of the world. And Apple is the same way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. I mean, it is interesting.
I seriously doubt Apple knocked off that phone, right? Yeah, in fact, I think it's more likely that phone was based on a leaked, you know, part from an Apple factory that mm-hmm. they rushed to market and then claimed that they had produced first. But
yeah, so apparently they're working with. I mean, Tim Cook just visited there. I don't know where the iBooks back in April or May. iBooks were also banned. The iBook store
right.
was banned.
I don't know where there's questions about the access to things like content is a very different thing. You know, mm-hmm. what films are allowed there, what you know, selling books has some very specific rules around it that might not exist in other parts of the world. It's a challenge, but, you know, Apple is, Tim Cook always says he's bullish on China. He thinks it will rapidly become Apple's, it's almost Apple's second biggest market. He thinks it will ultimately become Apple's biggest market, bigger than the U.S. market. And so they're all in on China, which means they're going to do everything they can to, you know, to be successful there and make the right moves and make sure that they're allowed to continue. Because people always said Apple would not succeed in China because their products were too expensive and all of that. And in truth, Apple has succeeded wildly in China and wants to keep doing that.
Yeah, and I think you're right with their investment in Didi. That was just sort of a peace offering of some kind.
Yeah, I mean, so working at IDG all those years, the guy who ran IDG, who founded it, Pat McGovern, he was one of the first Western businessmen in China. And what he always said is, you know, it's a complicated situation, and you have to show your understanding and commitment to China. And that's not, you know, they don't want you just rolling in from America and taking a lot of money and leaving the country. They're not interested in that. So it's complicated.
Mm-hmm. Well, we talk a lot about apps, and now is the app boom over? Can anyone make a successful app again? And we spoke earlier about Snapchat being big. And what I think is the another really popular app that kids are using, Musical.ly. Now, you said your kids don't use Musical.ly. They might be a little bit old, but have you heard of it?
No, I haven't. I've completely missed this one.
Musical.ly, it's an app that lets you lip sync and make videos, and it's, you know, it's all automated, so it makes you look like you spent hours on something that took you a couple minutes. So Vine, like, you can put them up on Vine and or, you know, on Instagram or other places. And, you know, people have gotten really, like, kids have gotten popular because their Musical.lys are so popular. They're all using it. And so they just recently launched a new app called Lively. It's live.ly that lets you live stream your Musical.ly. I thought it was worth mentioning. Wow. I haven't heard it in the tech press too much. I saw it on Product Hunt. But if anyone has kids out there, I thought they should probably know. I immediately spoke to mine about, like, hey, let's talk before you live stream yourself doing anything.
It's a good idea. Good advice.
Because, I mean, you know, obviously you can live stream using Twitter or Facebook or YouTube, but I don't think that kids have younger kids haven't really gotten into it. But I think with something like this that is aimed, I know a lot of 10-year-olds, 9-year-olds that love Musical.ly, like, they're not connected to it as a social network. They just make them and keep them on their own. But how do you feel about live streaming in particular with kids?
You know, I don't know. It's yet another thing to be worried about, I suppose, but in some ways, isn't it almost like Snapchat, where there's some danger there, but also there's this, at least, hope that you know, nobody's watching and it's mm-hmm. going to just go away at the end.
Right.
But yeah, talk about things I did not anticipate having to worry about as a parent. Like, do I want my children live streaming whatever it is? And not just like their lives, but like our lives in our house and stuff.
Right.
My daughter does that now where she's taking Snapchats of us. And I'm like, you should really ask before you grab video of your, you know, the other people in this house.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That, I mean, that's a popular thing in my house is like if you're yelling at your child, just make sure they're not Snapchatting.
Yeah, that's right. It's pretty evident.
Yeah, well, you say it's another thing to worry about. I say it's another thing to consider and talk to your children about.
Okay. All right, that's another way to view it. I mean, you definitely have to talk to them about it. Our children have to be much more media savvy, mm-hmm. right? Because they are living in a world where everybody is a media creator. And, you know, we do this for a living, right? And unlike a lot of people we know, we're like, we put things out in the world and people see what we're talking about, like right now. But kids on social media, in all these different ways, they're living it, like, every day. Their lives are, in part, a performance. And so they've got to start at very young ages thinking about, what are the ramifications of the performance I'm giving beyond just being around my friends? Like, who else is seeing this and what does that mean? And that's a 21st century life, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think Musical.ly is interesting, too, because it's a totally fun app. You know, you can make a music video with your friends, which is great. But then this idea that kids have that they have to, it doesn't exist unless they share it. And not just with their friends, but maybe with everyone. Mm. You know, it's just like you can play with it and then just keep it on your phone. So... All right, here's a piece of news about an app that was supposed to help people find refugees. So it was an app that was going to scan the Mediterranean and help find refugees. And a bunch of people on Twitter realized that it was fake. It's now been removed from the Apple App Store. But basically, it was nominated at the Cannes Lions Award show already. And that's what they suspect that maybe they were after. It had this very, you know, inspirational video about finding refugees, really like pushing people's sympathy buttons, which makes it even more unfortunate that it isn't true, isn't real. I'm not exactly sure how people figured out that it wasn't real. I think there were old screenshots, it was showing the weather from 2015. It just basically wasn't doing what it purported to do.
I don't think that the general public, at least, has access to live satellite video, essentially, of the world, right? I mean, there are some things that have certain views, and I'm sure there are spy satellites and things like that. But I think there's the idea. This is like how people, supposedly some people think that if you look at Google Maps or Google Earth, that you should be able to see yourself. And it's like, no, it doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
It's not live. It was shot, you know, years ago and stitched together. And this app is, I think, preying on that same idea that we should mm-hmm. be able to see the Mediterranean live. And that's not how it works, at least not yet. Perhaps someday, look, crowdsourcing something like this, just like they do with looking for exoplanets around other, you know, other stars or weird. I mean, there are lots of astronomy things, whether or something like SETI at Home. There are different ways of taking huge data and splitting it up. And so, sure, if there was a live video feed of the Mediterranean and people were served a little box and told, "Do you see anything in here?" Could you solve something like this? Probably could, but I'm not sure. I mean, that data doesn't exist right now, as far mm-hmm. as I know.
So, yeah, just another reminder to really check what you see in the news to see if it's accurate. And also, just are you surprised that it got in the App Store in the first place?
I don't know. I mean, one of the advantages of the new way they're doing business in the App Store is that things are getting approved a little bit sooner. Also, Apple's really good at approving things for technical reasons and searching for technical problems. This is a content problem, and this would require, especially since they're trying to approve everything faster, this requires somebody to say, wait a second, I'm not sure I believe that this app is doing what it says it's doing. But if the approver doesn't understand about what the data sources are, you know, they're really looking to say, does this thing do anything that's technically fishy? So I can see why it would have gotten by them. And this is the balance Apple has to strike, is that Apple really hears from people when they reject things or when they don't do anything with an app for a week because they're backlogged. But this is the other side of it, which is if they do try to expedite this process and approve stuff, sometimes some stuff's going to get through. This isn't malware, right? It's just fraudware, I guess.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I guess it is a good... the crowdsourcing that did work was that people figured out it wasn't true.
Yeah, there you
so
go.
So that's nice. All right, we talked a little bit already about the talk show. You were in the front row. Was there anything else that we missed that was, I mean, that was a more, as opposed to the big developers conference, that was a more intimate setting where John Gruber was talking to Craig Federighi and Phil Schiller. Was there anything big that we haven't already talked about that they talked about there that would be interesting?
I wish they would let Craig Federighi out more, because we see him on stage and he's this polished guy with the big tuft of hair on the top of his head, and he's funny and they make jokes. They really let loose with the jokes in that segment, but he's a technical guy. He's not a marketing guy. And at the talk show, he dropped some very technical knowledge, knowing that his crowd was almost entirely developers. And I was impressed by that, because again, going back to sort of like, how does Steve Jobs era Apple act? They wanted it to be a magic trick. They wanted it to be a black box. Like, never let them see you sweat. Never let them know how you do all the work you do to make this stuff awesome. Just try. Don't talk about it. The developers know, but, like, don't talk about it. I think that hearing Craig Federighi, the guy we see on stage, talk about the details of, like, he was talking about, like, sharing, like, share sheets and how you can pass data from one app to another, and how they had to build this process that has allowed them now to build more extensions into other apps. And he said, you know, we based it on this. And he gave a really technical description of it that I'm sure made Phil Schiller shift uneasily in his chair a little bit. But I really liked it, because even though I'm not a developer and I didn't understand a lot of what he was saying, I like the idea that Apple's sending the message that these are very talented, intelligent, technical people. Apple doesn't just release products magically. They think about it a lot. They make decisions. You can disagree with their decisions, but know that they're trying to make them for good reasons. They're trying to implement things in the right way, they think, technically. And I think that sometimes that doesn't come through enough when Apple communicates stuff. And to the general public, yeah, you don't want to do that, but being opening up a little bit more and saying, yeah, this is really hard stuff and we do sweat the details, I think is to their benefit. So I would love to see people like Craig Federighi appear in public a little bit more in nerdier circles, not necessarily on stage at keynotes all the time, and open up a little bit more about their technical acumen, because I think in the end it does make Apple look better, not worse, to admit that they are doing hard work and making tough decisions about the software that they're writing and the hardware they're building.
Absolutely. There was a moment in the keynote, I can't remember what he was talking about. It might have been Apple Pay on the web. But, you know, he showed it off and he said, oh, it's epic. And I was kind of laughing, you know, but because I was like, oh, it's great to be able to use Apple Pay on the web. I'll definitely use that. But just that, but now that you say it, it's like, because the technical stuff underneath that, the what they had to do to get there, right, that's what's epic. It's not just like, wow.
Yeah, because that's tied into the secure element on the iPhone, or it's tied into the watch. And that, so from an engineering standpoint, it's a challenge. The watch unlock for macOS Sierra is another example of that, where they're doing, and they mentioned this on stage, and this was a nerdy moment that I really liked. They can't just have it be the presence of your watch unlocks it. They actually measure the speed that it took for the signal to get from your watch to your Mac, which means they're measuring essentially the speed of light. How fast do the radio waves travel? And he said the reason we do that is because theoretically, and this would be like on a spy TV show, they could have a little retransmitter that follows you, you know, the mark around, you know, miles away, and retransmits that carrier signal from the watch into the room where their Mac is and unlocks it. And that would be a security hole. So instead, they measure the timestamp and the difference in time from when it was sent and when it was received. And it's over, if it's over about the distance, the time it takes for light or radio waves to travel 3 feet, it won't accept it and it won't unlock.
Wow.
And that's just, I mean, that's crazy. And they're using the speed of light as a way to measure distance, which totally makes sense from the math perspective. But I liked it because it showed this is the stuff they worry about. This is how they built this. It a little glimpse behind the scenes that I think makes it a better story. And again, I'm not sure how much of that he was authorized to talk about. You do get the sense that he talks about some stuff that they'd rather kind of keep quiet. But it makes them, I think, seem smarter and better knowing that they sweat the magic tricks.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm really excited about that, opening my Mac with my watch. And I do wonder now, though, if it's going to be a situation like you had, you know, when you're at the airport and trying to scan your boarding pass and you do this sort of gymnastics of, you know, or even like Apple Pay. I wonder if it'll be like that if you're sitting in.
No, it's we'll see how it's implemented, but it's all, I mean, it's not even trying to read like an NFC or something. It's just the Bluetooth or Wi-Fi. It's continuity, so it's one of those. And so just the proximity should do it, but that's the question, right?
Yeah.
Are we all going to be like, all right, Mac, come on, unlock, or is it just going to be second nature? You flip it open and your wrist is right there while you're flipping your laptop open and it immediately unlocks.
Yeah. It's going to work. Will it work with your desktop too, or just a laptop?
I think so. I think it just needs to be a system that is modern enough to have Bluetooth LE because that's what all the continuity features work with.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's all part and parcel, but it's close range too. You're not going to be able to unlock your Mac accidentally from down the hallway. There's some good security features built into it because they know that's super clever, right?
Mm-hmm.
Using iOS devices to unlock your Mac and pay for things. That's Apple at its best, I think, mm-hmm. is getting its products to all work together.
Absolutely. All right. Well, we have some questions from you and some comments that we will get to as soon as we talk about Ratchio. Ratchio is your sprinkler system, but smarter. So you probably have, if you have a sprinkler system, you probably have already used sprinkler timers. This is much more interesting. It takes into account the weather, and it's all on an app on your phone, which is great. Ratchio is a smart sprinkler controller. It lets you control your home irrigation system. It's Wi-Fi enabled to allow instant access with a mobile app and has automatic watering schedules based on the latest weather forecasts. That's going to save you money. It easily will adjust depending on the weather. So you can stop stressing about manually unplugging your controller, changing the settings for rain. Ratchio is simple to install. It takes less than 30 minutes. It's easy to set up using an iOS app. You can also use an Android app if you have an Android phone. It connects with popular smartphone platforms like Nest, Amazon Alexa, Nexia, Control 4, iControl, a few more also. You can run zones directly from the controller, giving you or your landscape professional manual access. With Ratchio's weather intelligence, it will automatically adjust your schedule for weather events so you don't have to worry about turning them off. You'll even get alerts whenever Ratchio steps in to adjust schedules for rain. Ratchio is EPA WaterSense certified and tested to the industry's highest standards. You can save up to 50% on your outdoor watering bill while helping save over 1 billion gallons of water nationwide, which is great in California where there's a drought and other places as well. You can check with your local water provider for rebates up to 100% of the cost of the Ratchio controller. Over 1 billion gallons of water has been saved, and more is being saved every day. So thank you for all the people already using Ratchio. Go to ratchio.com/twit to learn more about the Ratchio Smart Sprinkler Controller and to find out if you're eligible for a rebate from your water provider. Change the way you water with Ratchio at ratchio.com/twit. That's ratchio.com/twit. All right, so Janice Glover asks if we have reviewed the Spark email app.
Mm.
She says it's her new favorite. Have you used Spark?
Yeah, it's good. It's good. It's from Rettle, right?
Yes.
Rettle Docs and all of that. Spark. Yeah, it's good. It's smart. It's got lots of nice gestures. It's got some interesting organizational features. There's a whole class of these things, but it's a good one. That it's a very good app, and it keeps getting better.
I think I have it here. Let me make sure I have no personal emails before you show it.
Yeah, that's the challenge with demoing this stuff, isn't it?
Here's what it looks like. I think Janet's main interest in this was that she had used Outlook and she had used a couple other email programs that let you swipe, and there wasn't enough customization for
mm-hmm.
the swiping, specifically on Outlook. Do you do Inbox Zero by swiping and returning later to the email?
No, my inbox is in the millions at this point. but yeah, I have tried with Mailbox. I tried it, and I tried it with Spark for a while. I'm using Outlook right now, and definitely the idea there is I either archive it or it just sits in my inbox. The problem I've had is that you really want the same thing everywhere for this to work right. And since I sit at a Mac every day too, it's like getting something that's going to work on the Mac and on my iPad and on my iPhone all together, it's tough. So right now I'm just sort of using different, I'm actually using a different app on all the platforms, but I use Outlook on my iPad because I like Outlook, and I think I think Microsoft did a really good job with the iOS version of Outlook. But I get Janice's point here too that Spark's got a lot of different gesture support and customization and stuff like that, which is great. There are a lot of amazing alternatives to Mail. Of course, Apple Mail, you'll be able to remove it. It stays there, but it's hidden in iOS 10, and there are a lot of great alternatives to Mail that are out there.
Yeah, I mean, I use Inbox for Google. Or Inbox for Gmail.
Yeah, I thought about that. I used that a while ago, and I haven't gotten back to it. But since I do use Gmail, I could use that, and I've thought about that. I mean, really, there are so many good, interesting options, and most of them are cheap or free. I think it's worth, if you're dissatisfied with how your email is working, I think you should try out any of these. Spark, Outlook, Airmail, Inbox. There are so many that are alternatives to Apple Mail.
Yeah, Stan Cook, who watches the show, he recommends Airmail Free. That is his favorite. And that you can get an app for across platform on the Mac, too. Yeah, Inbox for Google, for me, really works. It just works. Not on my Apple Watch, but it works on my iPad and my iPhone and my Mac. And in addition to, like, swiping and you can return later, you know, the email will come back later. It'll come back whenever. Next week, tomorrow, it's very specific, or whenever I plan to.
I like those features. It's a good idea. I wish Apple would embrace that a little bit more, the idea that your inbox is essentially your to-do list, and you can set messages to leave your inbox and come back later, boomerang back in when you want to deal with them, instead of just leaving them stacking up like what I do. There's too much email.
Well, I mean, I started doing it on my Twitter account, which is, you know, not even 2 years old yet. So I think, you know, my personal email is a mess. But the thing that I like most about Inbox for Gmail, which I think Apple will probably never do or not ever do as well as the smart replies, it offers me 3 replies based on what it, you know, it goes through machine learning and reads all my emails and, you know, decides what it thinks that I'm going to answer. And it's really accurate. I mean, a lot of just save time, thanks, no thank you, I'll do it, no, I need you to do it, you know. I mean, sometimes it's laughably wrong, but a lot of times it just saves so much time.
Yeah, it's possible Apple will do that, but if they do, it's going to be machine learning on the device, right? Because that's what we've discovered, is that's how Apple's going to approach this, is just use your device to do all of that stuff. But you're right, Apple, who knows? Maybe Apple will discover that people use Mail a lot, and they'll they'll improve it, too.
Maybe that's the next thing. Notes, messages, Mail. Mail will be the next thing.
I don't know. I'm not sure people use Mail a lot, but
I know
anymore.
That's true. That is sad. Yeah, my husband is on vacation with one of our kids and sent me a picture by email. That was so
quaint.
I know, it was so quaint. I was like, oh, like, who does that? You know, he doesn't have Snapchat. He doesn't have any sharing capabilities. Just like, send it to me.
Email.
An email. Here's an email from David in Belfast, Northern Ireland. He writes, you and Leo were very positive on Gboard and Hound, so I was eager to download them both, but they are not in the UK App Store. I can access the US App Store, but I need a credit card registered in the US to download even these free apps. So,
yeah, it's something. It's hard to tell from the perspective of the U.S. sometimes what's available overseas and what isn't. You know, they don't tell us that. They're like, hey, we have a new app, and we download it and we use it, and then we write about it, and then discover, oh, other countries don't have access to that. Sometimes, like Gboard is a good example. It's like, I'm not even sure quite why not.
Yeah. Well, they do now. It is now in the Canadian App Store and the
UK
App Store.
That's good. So my tip for anybody outside of the U.S. who gets frustrated by this is, if you or any friends of yours are in the U.S., I believe you can still sign up for a U.S. App Store account with a gift card.
Oh.
And then you can use that account. I think that was always the way. I haven't tried it lately, but that was the last I heard, is that you could get a gift card when you're here and sign up, and then you've got an active iTunes
great.
account. I think you can do that.
And so it's just you can get the free apps, because that's the problem. Gboard doesn't cost anything. You don't actually they don't need to charge a credit card, but they need to.
Region locked, which is very frustrating for a free app to be region locked like that.
Yeah, and Hound apparently is not available in the UK App Store yet. Do you use Hound?
No.
Mm. It's a search. Leo recommends it. It's also SoundHound. It's sort of a finding music sort of app. Same company.
Ah.
We talked a little bit about this, but I think it's worth talking again. David Kendall Grant writes on Twitter, side-by-side Apple Watch battle, watchOS 3 beta versus watchOS 2 beta. OS 3 ran out almost 3 hours before OS 2. Ouch. Now, do you think this is because it's a beta, or like you said before, that they really are using up more battery life, and that's a good thing as long as you make it to the end of the day?
Well, betas are notoriously bad at battery. They're just, you know, developers are not doing their battery lockdown in betas. They're waiting until they get close to shipping. So that could be it, but it's absolutely also the case that watchOS 3 is using more battery purposefully because they feel like they've got the battery life to burn, and so they're going to use it to make the experience better. So at least some of that is on purpose. So, ouch, I don't know. If my apps launch faster and I can still get through the end of the day, then I don't really care whether I get through the day at 5% or 40% of battery life. And that's what they're hoping.
Excellent.
But that's good. That's nice that somebody's already checking that out. But still, yes, battery testing betas, that way lies madness. Don't even... Just, it's not, I always, when I was testing beta software, people would ask about battery life and be like, don't ask me. It's like, because it changes from build to build, it changes. Mm-hmm. And really until the final, you don't know how the performance and speed testing, battery testing, it's all in flux until it finally ships.
It's the same thing about apps, like saying, you know, especially on Twitter, like, oh, so-and-so app doesn't work in the beta of iOS 10. Don't do that, right?
Yeah, of course it doesn't. The person who developed that app never saw the beta because it just came out. So, yeah, exactly right. That's the nature of it. You can't... somebody was saying, oh, iOS 10 is terrible with battery life based on the beta. Like, don't do that. It's like, that doesn't tell us anything about battery life for the final version of iOS 10 because they probably don't care about battery life right now. It's for developers to write apps, not for users to take with them all day.
So if you're not planning on writing an app, is there any reason to, and I guess you're not a journalist, is there any reason to download the betas?
Any reason? Sure, because it's new and cool, and who doesn't want to watch, you know, the latest stuff and play with the latest stuff? But it's a bad idea. It's a bad idea. I think the public beta is a little bit better because then Apple has felt like it's safe enough for you to test it, but I'd say resist temptation for now. First betas are notorious for being problematic. Mm-hmm. There are always bugs that come out. Because keep in mind, first beta has not been used by anybody outside of Apple. And then you open it up to the developers, and they find lots of bugs. And some of those bugs get fixed in beta 2. Some of them don't. And then there's beta 3. At somewhere in there, the public beta will probably also be released. But they'll be sure that that's not a particularly destructive or awful beta. And even then, you should really only do it if you're feeling adventurous.
Yeah. I want to ask you, because I have you here, about one thing you wrote a couple weeks about Google's material design.
Oh, yeah.
We talked about it a little bit on Tech News Today because I found it so interesting. Why don't you explain a little bit about your point?
Well, I complained that material design, a lot of Google's apps use material design on iOS. And in fact, up until recently, they were really aggressively material designed to the point where, like, the Share app was not the iOS Share app or Share icon. It was the Google material design Share icon. And my thought was, you're a guest when you're on somebody else's platform, you're a guest in someone else's home. The users expect platform conventions to hold. And I likened it to when Mac users got a new version of Microsoft Office in the 90s and it looked like Office for Windows. Mm-hmm. The feeling was that Microsoft didn't really respect Mac users for choosing the Mac and instead felt like the most important thing was that people who supported Office got the same experience doing tech support on Mac and Windows by making them identical, which was exactly the wrong decision. And a few years later, they came out with a new version, which was like the apology edition of Microsoft Office. And I felt like the same thing was an issue with Google, where every time I open some of the Google apps on iOS, I feel like, come on, Google, I'm not using your platform. I'm using Apple's platform. Please behave like a good guest in Apple's platform. I'm not a Google user. I'm an iPad user. I want this to behave like an iPad app. And, you know, I got some feedback from people who are like, well, you know, what about Apple making iTunes for Windows or Apple Music for Android? And my answer was, and it's in the column, yeah, when Apple is a guest in someone else's platform, they need to follow the conventions of that platform. Mm-hmm. I also heard from some people who said, material design, it's not Android, it's all over the web too. And it's like, well, that's true, and the web has no conventions, so Google's making their own, but iOS has conventions, and Google should follow them. And the best example is the share icon. I mean, I look at some Google apps and I think, I don't even know what button to press. It's like, mm-hmm. oh, this is what they must mean by it, but it looks totally different. That said, in the last 3 months, something has happened to the Google apps on iOS. They are... they now use the iOS icon for sharing, for example. So it sounds to me, and I've heard from like people who have heard from people, that Google on iOS is has changed its tune a little bit. Famously, Matthias Duarte at Google said, you know, we don't want to use the iOS share icon because Google is more important. And that was a cause a firestorm of criticism, right? But now... they have gone back on that. And I think there are designers inside Google who said, look, when we're on iOS, we need to be a good iOS app. And I hope that continues. You know, a lot of the Google apps still don't support split screen. They don't support the iPad Pro size or didn't for a long time. They're still kind of lagging behind a little bit. But I'm hopeful that Google is going to embrace iOS conventions a little bit more with their apps because I use Google services all the time. But on my iPad, I don't want to feel like I'm suddenly in some totally different operating system because Google has decided that's more important than me being comfortable as an iPad user.
Right. That makes sense. Yeah. I mean, the only example, I mean, you gave the example of Apple Music on Android, and it does look like an Android app.
Granted, it came from Beats. So they were a little less focused on the Apple versus Android thing back mm-hmm. when it was just Beats. But yeah, they use the share icon, the little three blobs that is on Android, and that's how it should be. And if iTunes for Windows didn't look like a Windows app, then I guess it would be about as disappointing as iTunes for Mac is. Mm-hmm. you know, you got to be a good guest, I think, because the users are not interested in your petty battles over which platform is going to reign supreme. The users just want to get their work done. And I think it's arrogant for any vendor to think that, oh, well, the users, we're more important. Google is more important to an iPad user than the iPad. I think that is always wrong.
Mm-hmm. Right, I agree. all right, well, we both have a favorite app of the week, and we will wear caps. But first, let's talk about Tracker. Here's my tracker on my keys along with everything else. It's actually the most beautiful thing on my keys. And it helps me find my keys, and it helps me find my phone. And they also have this new water-resistant sleeve. I can put the tracker inside, put the tracker on my dog, and it can help find my dog, which is great if you have a dog like mine that weighs 100 pounds and likes to get out of the gate and terrorize the neighbor's chickens. That's not a good thing. This episode is brought to you by Tracker. They are a sponsor. We have smart cars. We have smartphones. But sometimes we don't feel so smart with our stuff. Tracker is a coin-sized device that locates misplaced keys, wallets, bags, computers, even pets in seconds. Just pair Tracker to your smartphone, attach to any item, and find its precise location with a tap of a button. You can customize two-way separation alerts to receive notifications before you forget your item. If you lose your phone, press the Tracker button and your phone rings, even if it's on silent. With over 1.5 million devices, Tracker has the largest crowd GPS network in the world, so your lost item shows up on a map, even if it is miles away. The Tracker app records your lost item's last known location on a map. When another Tracker user comes within a 100-foot range of your item, you'll receive a GPS update of your item's location. Tracker is also partnered with leading companies like HP, allowing companies to build trackable products and utilize the scale of Tracker's Crowd GPS network. Tracker is enabled by Bluetooth low energy, so the battery lasts up to 1 year. You can also purchase a water-resistant case like the one I showed you. It's great for pet collars. Also, the recently introduced Tracker Atlas works with your Tracker Bravo or your third-party Bluetooth tracker to pinpoint your items on a customizable floor plan of your home. So save time and energy by simply asking Tracker Atlas where your item is, and you will instantly get an answer. No need to search. Never lose anything again with Tracker. The hardest thing you'll ever have to find is their website. Go to thetracker.com and never lose your possessions again. Plus, just for our audience, if you enter promo code iOS today, you'll get 30% off your entire order. That's thetracker.com. Promo code iOS today for 30% off your entire Tracker order. Thanks, Tracker, for supporting iOS today. This is the point where we wear hats. Oh, so I guess we have a fairy tale theme, perhaps. Or I don't know if Alice in Wonderland is a fairy tale. Or
pirates, for that matter. Pirates
or rogue people. So why don't you go first and tell us your favorite app, because we're wearing caps, app cap.
It rhymes. Bitcam. Bitcam is my choice. It's from the Icon Factory. It is a, it's kind of a novelty app, but it's really adorable. It is an app that emulates low-quality photography from the early Macintosh days. There's an in-app purchase to enable monochrome mode. All of the app windows and settings fly forward in the style of classic Mac OS with big OK buttons and lots of different options. The idea is it's an app that has fallen through a wormhole from 20 years ago onto your iPhone, but you end up with a lot of these kind of crazy black and white dithered images that look great in their badness, and somebody was saying on Twitter the other day, it makes a boring photo look interesting because it's got all the dithering and everything like that. And I talked to the developer Craig Hockenberry last week, and he said the challenge of making something that looks like it came from the Mac 20 years ago, like the little rectangles that grow out and then a window appears, it's like the iPhone is so good that it took a lot of work to make it look bad. Mm-hmm. But the result is a lot of fun.
I love, that when we, use an app to make our technology go backwards.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like Instagram filters or something like that, where you're really trying to make it seem retro. So this is retro computer tech from 20 years ago.
So are you a big fan of, Instagram filters, or only when they make your photos look bad?
No, I like them. I mean, because I'm never going to use all those presets myself in the Photos app and slide the colors around and all that. And so the fact that somebody has done those presets for me, and some of the photos that I try to post on Instagram, they totally look better when they look like they were shot out of an old camera. So
that's true.
Sometimes they're the best.
Yeah. I had a friend who's in Hawaii, and she posted a picture, and it was using a filter. And I know the no filter thing is old, but I did have that moment. It's like, you're in Hawaii. Like, why would you need a filter? Everything's wonderful.
It's true. Sometimes I feel that way where I get a beautiful photo and I'm like, I got to say that this is no filter
because
people won't believe it, but it's true.
So it's called Bitcam.
Bitcam. From the Icon Factory. Free with in-app purchase if you want to enable color mode.
Mm-hmm. Mine is Popflake. Now you do a lot of entertainment podcasts. You watch a lot. I respect your opinion, but I bother you enough, so I can't always ask you when I'm looking. Are you taking a Bitcam?
I am.
Okay, good. So have you heard of Popflake?
I haven't.
The app.
Tell
okay.
Me.
So this is if you've been with your it's on the iPad, but not it's that way. So I'll do it on the iPhone. That's better. So you can't really see. But you can see there's a lot of words that I'm going to choose. You're with your family or with your partner or by yourself, and you just can't decide what movie you want to watch. It's a huge pain. So I think actually it's better if I show it on here because it's big, and I'll do like that. So what are you interested in? Accident movie, action movie, alien art, beach, black and white, British cars?
Agents.
Agents?
Agents.
Okay.
Yes.
Agents. All right. So there's 105 movies. We can choose another one.
Oh, British agents.
British,
so the best
British
kinds of agents.
Agents.
James Bond. And Hot Fuzz. Oh, well, that's good.
So have you seen all these? Or the?
I've seen most of those, yeah.
I've never even heard of those. So it's going to recommend the movie based, and now, of course, it's one of those.
You should watch Hot Fuzz. That's a good one.
Okay.
You'd like it.
I really like this, except for I chose, like, with children and family, I don't think it's that great. So, like, I chose family and then coming of age. Let's see. So I guess it depends on in your family whether Juno would be appropriate. Mm. Harry Potter's good. Princess Diaries. Star Wars. So it just gets... Let's see how specific we can get. Oh. Ooh. Family, coming of age, desert. Those are your two choices.
Yep.
Episode 5 and episode 4. Pop Flake is free. I think it's good to, you know, if you just need some suggestions. I wish it told me, well, I don't actually... Oh, murder. where to get it. It gives you some details about the movie, which is good. I guess you can... I don't know what that button does. But I wish it would tell me where it was streaming. That
right.
would be more helpful.
That would be useful.
But Pop Flake is free if you don't have Jason Snell with you recommending movies all the time.
You're just down a Star Wars hole now.
I guess
You're
I
in
am.
A Sarlacc pit
Yeah,
of
get
movies.
A coming of age. Well, I don't want it to be dark. Okay, if it's not dark, episode 6 works too. So Pop Flake is my app cap. Hmm. Have you ever heard of any of these movies? We're the Millers?
Yeah.
Is that good?
No. Jason Sudeikis and Jeff Aniston, right?
So, yeah. That's pretty much
it. So you can figure it out from there?
Right. I wish it had some more options like that. Meh. That's not an option if you're looking for a meh movie. Plane. It looks like they really want me to watch Star Wars.
You should watch Star Wars. They
so
think
Pop
they
Flake.
Know what you're in the mood for.
Yeah, I wonder if it used, because I'm kind of always in the mood for Star Wars, so
there's
it's,
nothing wrong with
it's
that.
Accurate. Jason, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm happy to sit in for Leo. It's always a pleasure to be here, even if you make me wear the funny hat. Okay.
Well, yeah, we let you approve the hats now. There was a big disaster the last time you filled in. And
that was not a good hat. Not a good hat. I got to bring my own hats. From now on.
So did we miss anything in the beginning? You do the Incomparable. Everything is at Six Colors.
SixColors.com, theincomparable.com, and then I do some tech podcasting at relay.fm, and those are the best places to find me.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And at Jason Snell, or at J Snell.
At J Snell on Twitter, yeah.
So, yeah, that's where you can follow. Thanks so much. And thanks you to everyone here. If you want to email me, you can email me at megan@twit.tv if you have suggestions of topics. Or complaints, or anything that you would like to email me. Or I'm at Twitter, on Twitter at Megan Maroney. You can always DM me. We do our show live every Monday between 12:30 and 1:30 on time today because Jason's here. But next week, Leo will be back, and we will start when he's ready. And you can find us at twit.tv/iOS. Thanks for watching.